This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Pierce Freelon is well known in the Triangle for his ambitious and creative projects. He often performs on stage with his band, The Beast, teaches about the intersection of politics and hip-hop, and he's the co-founder, or I should say the founder, of the Black Space Project, which helps black and brown youth create multimedia to reflect their identities. Pierce's passion for community building drove him to run for mayor of Durham. He comes from a long line of influencers and activists. His politically minded grandmother, who he calls Queen Mother Frances Pierce, was prominent in the community activism. His mother is a Grammy-nominated artist, Nina Freelon. His father, renowned architect Phil Freelon. All of them have developed a deep influence on his work. And Pierce Freelon joins me now in the studio. Welcome to State of Things.
Thank you very much, Frank. Good to see you.
Good to see you. You performed all around the world. You've done projects all around the world, but you're rooted right here in Durham. Talk about growing up in Durham.
Yeah, Durham is a beautiful place, and it's a real privilege to be of this community, and it's shaped me in so many ways. My parents, each individually, have shaped kind of my identity and my personality, but also this rich community. People like Baba Chuck Davis, one of my mentors. Places like the No Bookstore.
Growing up,
going to lectures at North Carolina Central University. That's where I saw my first Black Panther, the real Black Panther, before $1 billion T'Challa. I was at B.N. Duke Auditorium in Durham. It's Bobby Seale, like a co-founder of the Black Panthers. I was there, so
So talk about, how old were you? Let's stop there. About seeing Bobby Seale, Black Panther, giving a talk at NCCU, right?
Yeah.
How old were you, and what impact did that have on you?
Well, it had a huge impact. Growing up in Durham, I was initially at E.K. Poe Elementary School. E.K. Poe, place to grow. Shouts to all my Poe grads. In fact, my bandmate in The Beast, Stephen Kaufman, and I met playing kickball on that field on 9th Street many moons ago. But I remember I transferred to Immaculata, which is a private school close by, after my brother started school there. And it was interesting transition because I went from this really kind of diverse environment to an environment where I was like the only black kid in my fourth grade class. And it was really isolating. And one of the first times I became like aware of my racial identity in that way. Because
and that would have been what, late 80s?
Yeah, this would have been actually early 90s. Okay. Yeah, this would have been early 90s. And so, I remember in fifth grade, there were two black boys that joined our class, Kevin Dawson and Brandon Palmer, still the homies to this day. but at that time, we had to kind of huddle and cloister to kind of preserve a sense of identity and safety and protection and solidarity and all that. And so at the same time, I'm like studying, about the Black Panther Party and learning about this history and learning about this legacy. And my dad took all of us to go see Bobby Seale speak. And I remember thinking I looked like Huey Newton. I felt like he was like the coolest young, radical activist. And so I wanted to be him, especially after I learned about, here's a situation where black people are being oppressed on the West Coast. And they're like, hey, we're going to take our right to bear arms and protect ourselves because the police ain't going to do it for us. They have their 10-point program. They're doing free breakfast programs, stuff that the government is now kind of learning from, this kind of radical black activist group. And I saw myself in that. And it was really an important space for me to feel reflected and protected, especially after that transition, into an environment where I was like one of few black faces.
At which point, your father, a very well respected architect, goes to work every day in a suit and then says, you need to see this. You need to come see Bobby Seale with us. Let's get in the car and go.
Yeah, I mean, my dad, and when I really reflect on who the the radicals in my household were, you mentioned Queen Mother Frances Pierce. She was it. She was the dashiki rockin', queen mother who is dragging us to everywhere, dragging us to church, dragging us to the mosque, dragging us to the no bookstore, and
stop. The second time we mentioned the no, talk about the no bookstore. Not there anymore, but the influence of that and the importance of that institution in Durham.
Sure, yeah. So on Fayetteville Street, long ago, there was a bookstore called the No, and it's KNOW, right. The No Bookstore. And we used to go there. That's where I used to get our bean pies from the Nation of Islam. Right. Always had a stack of bean pies waiting for your boy at the bookstore. And it was a black radical bookstore. Right. It's the only place in Durham where you could find. I mean, we have great bookstores in Durham. Right. You know, the Regulator. There's a lot of them have closed, but there's Books Do Furnish a Room, one of my favorites over by 9th Street. But the No Bookstore was a black bookstore. And it was a store where, you know, you could find, you know, clothing and trinkets and artifacts and community that was really kind of based in that black radical tradition that, you know, alongside Durham's historic Black Wall Street is like a hallmark of our history and legacy as kind of a thriving black intellectual and politically active hub. And, you know, Polly Murray is a part of that legacy. Ernie Barnes is a part of that legacy. And it's really, you know, that it was a staple, and it was really sad to see it go. And in fact, the woman who owns that building, Miss Mozella McLaughlin, who turned 100 last year, was a babysitter of ours. So we used to kick it at her house, and she was really close friends with Granny Franny, or Queen Mother. And you know, so this was the community that I was raised in. I went to a day camp, the Harriet Tubman Day Camp. Was here in Durham. There's been like a long tradition of folks who've been about that woke life for quite some time.
Some time, yeah.
You know, so
we talk more about Granny Franny. She's your mother's mom, right? And so talk about her and her sense of what it meant to be black, because she really reminded you. I mean, you couldn't ask for French toast and not be reminded.
Oh man, right? Yeah, French toast. Oh my God. To this day, whenever my sister and I hear the words French toast, we like give each other a look. So here's the backstory. So yeah. My grandmother, my sister and I used to stay at Granny Franny's house every summer. And, you know, one day she asked us what we want for breakfast, and we request French toast, to which she kind of gives us a scrunch face, like, French toast? She's like, you see any French people in here? I'm African. You want some African toast. If I'm making the toast, it's African toast. I don't care what it is. So my sister and I look at each other. We kind of roll our eyes like, okay, really? African toast? We're like, okay, can we have African toast, please? And it's the same thing. You take some Jiffy bread, cut it into triangles. You dip it in egg juice.
Yeah.
And you fry it.
Right.
But that's African toast, according to
she wanted you to be conscious of that. But this is incredible. And this is the city of Durham, too. So I know you've done some research since. I mean, the fact that this had a thriving middle class, black middle class, is a place where these things are held very closely together. A sense of strong black nationalism, African identity, and, you know, making a living, right? A good living.
Yeah, making a living. And I think, you know, my dad, that's what my dad did.
Yeah.
He went to NC State. He came down here from Philly, and he found something really special in the Triangle in general, but in Durham specifically. You know, when my dad was growing up, he looked to Julian Abel, who was one of the premier black architects of his time, who designed much of Duke's campus and was the only black, one of the few black architects, one of a handful of black architects that my dad could look to and say and aspire towards. And that those roots are right here in Durham. And so, you know, when my dad got here in the late 70s, you know, there was something about this area that resonated with him, and he planted seeds in this very rich soil. I think of, you know, my parents are kind of like the gardeners that tended that, but the soil was Durham. The soil was like I said, Baba Chuck and Polly Murray and
Maya Angelou.
Maya Angelou, definitely. Yeah,
it was somebody you knew and looked at as a mentor, right?
Yeah, Auntie Maya. my sister is named after Dr. Angelou, and she was a godmother to my mom, Nina, and she was close friends with Queen Mother, and you know, she lived in Winston-Salem, and so we would go see her from time to time, and she always had wisdom and nuggets and love and nuzzles for us. And, you know, that she was a part of that same tradition and legacy of you know, of creative resistance, the role that she played in the movement. Like so many of our great leaders were multifaceted. When I think of Polly Murray, was also a poet, you know, and a spiritual leader.
And a priest, and a lawyer.
And a lawyer, you know, just multiple identities. And I think the same thing of Dr. Angelou. She was an artivist. She was an artist. She was an activist. She was an actor. You know, she had just a wide variety of skills and gifts to offer us. And
you know, you talk about being woke, though, the idea of I mean, part of that is a kind of biological maturity, right? You have to reach a certain age before any of this starts making sense. What was all this like to you as a young man growing up? I mean, it can be oppressive, I would think, at some level. Maybe it wasn't, but it might be.
Well, no, I mean, yeah. I mean, even going back to the African toast story, we were looking at our grandmother like, what are you doing? Like,
yeah.
You know, like, we didn't understand at the time or appreciate the seeds that she was planting in us, and it wasn't until later that those seeds are bearing fruit, and we kind of emulate our grandmother in a lot of ways. We've internalized some of the blessings that the things she whispered in our ears as young folks that were annoying or that felt overbearing. Mm-hmm. Because it felt like she was trying to impose something that was oppositional to everything else we were seeing. We walk in Granny Franny's house, there's black Jesus on the wall, but at the church, you know, we go to, you know, back home, it's like, why everything gotta be black, Granny Franny? Why are you always rocking some African print? Like, you know, like, and so, I think that we had to develop and evolve ourselves to appreciate something that wasn't being affirmed elsewhere.
We're going to talk more about that in a minute. I'm talking to Pierce Freelon. He is a hip-hop artist, community organizer, founder of Black Space, Afrofuturist, all of that and more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We're going to spend the hour today with Pierce Freelon, hip-hop artist and community organizer. He's founder of a place called Black Space, which is an Afrofuturist youth group, among the many other projects. But let's talk about your teen years growing up, because both of your parents' careers, your mom decided to get into music more deeply. In fact, talk about that decision, because that's not an easy decision to make, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm the youngest of three, and when I kind of got old enough to navigate the world,
he's like four and a half.
Yeah, right. So she had a tough choice. So she was thinking about kind of getting back into work, you know, she initially came down here from Cambridge to be a nurse. She was studying to become a nurse. But she also had this passion for music and passion for singing. And so she had a choice when I was old enough, like, okay, what do I want to do? Do I go back into nursing or do I pursue this music career? And I've, you know, especially now as an adult looking back, I have so much kind of respect and admiration for her choice to pursue her passion for music. And to my wife sent me a message earlier today over Instagram. It was like, you can't dance with the opportunity if you don't get on the dance floor. You know what I mean?
That's great.
And so she decided to get on that dance floor, and she started right here in Durham. It was like Brother Yusuf and Dr. Wiggins and North Carolina Central that nurtured her in her early days. It was the Bembe Festival. We saw her at Centerfest before she ever performed at the Grammys, you know, or ever toured internationally. So, you know, again, very cognizant and appreciative of Durham and the way that it's nurtured both of my parents' professional careers.
And the fact that both of them were engaged in their careers, but also with their families. And so I guess you learned at an early age that you can kind of have it both ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask me about, you know, my parents traveling or being busy, but, you know, we were there. My dad would bring us to the office, and our playgrounds became his, you know, office spaces. He always had a room, which was like a room where they would build models or do drafts and have blueprints spread out everywhere. We called them the boom boom rooms. And we would just be running around, you know, the drafting tables. And same for my mom. She would bring us to sound check, and we'd be backstage at the Carolina Theater, you know, as she's performing. And her bandmates didn't know that when they were signing up for the gig, they'd also be like pseudo babysitters hanging out. But, you know, they became part of our family. And their work became part of our playgrounds and our lives.
You toured with your mom, right?
Yeah, I was probably about 11 or 12 years old when my mom did several weeks in Japan and in Helsinki.
Yeah.
And that was really my first time kind of leaving the country and being able to see the world and different cultures and learn new languages. And it was really, really beautiful experience and a powerful one, and one that I feel is a really big privilege, especially now and having been able to travel. I want to provide that opportunity for others and young folks as well. That's one of the things, one of the goals of Black Space, is to get kids out of Durham and see how big the world is and the role that they can play in shaping their own world.
Is that when you got bitten by the performance bug?
That's a good question. I think I got bitten by the performance bug on North Duke Street at Durham School of the Arts in middle school. I was one of the DMC players. Now that's real old school, because that was back when the Durham School of the Arts was called the Durham Magnet Center.
That DMC,
yeah, Run DMC.
Which I think it said don't run. But anyway, I get it.
Yeah, DSA, I got into that elite theater troupe in seventh grade. And just a couple weeks ago, I did a performance, and my theater teacher, Miss Graves, who's at a new school now, I just told her how impactful it was for her to see something in me and to pull it out of me and to put me on a stage. That was really big deal. Before that, I didn't know that I had a knack for theater or was interested in performance. Certainly grew up around performers, but hadn't really stepped into that until Durham School of the Arts.
So you're having all of these heady experiences, but it's not like you're still not rooted in the neighborhood. You got to know some neighborhood folks at the BP station near where you lived, right?
Yeah, down the street from my house. I grew up in the Moorhead Hills neighborhood, which is, kind of, there's like three neighborhoods adjacent to each other: Moorhead Hills, Forest Hills, and then the St. Teresa neighborhood, which is now like rapidly being gentrified. Mm. But that BP, in front of what's now Compare Foods, was the hangout spot.
Yeah.
And the guy who ran the gas station he was a mentor of mine. He was a guy that I looked up to and who gave me a lot of wisdom and taught me a lot of things, important lessons, street smarts that are still kind of with me today.
Including what to stay away from.
Including what to stay away from.
Even though it was part of his business.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
I mean.
That's learning, right? That's life learning.
Yeah, I mean, he was, in addition to selling gas, he was selling some other items, and I learned about that business as well. But yeah, I mean, even though he was a medicinal herbs dealer.
Right.
He told me he was schooling me to the game, like about here's the deal with marijuana. This is stay away from coke. Like, I know a lot of people get caught up in this. And I got to meet a lot of Durham's homeless population would come through there. Yeah. I got to meet, folks who are very much a part of our community. We'd be like on our way to a Bulls game and the brothers would come up to me like, "Hey, Pierce, like, what's going on, man?" My parents would be like, "How do you know these guys?" I'm like, "Oh, I see them at the gas station." So it was an interesting space for me to find solidarity and camaraderie and community and mentorship.
But I think that points to the complexity of all this, that really learning is going to happen. It can happen anywhere. And some of it can be a little bit on the dangerous side. I mean, you're in a place where who knows what's going to happen next. But when your sort of heart's in the right place and you're looking for that, I mean, this is not a recommendation to go send your children to the BP. But what I'm saying here is that there is a way in which one can draw an education from almost any experience if you're open to it.
Yeah, and I mean, when you mentioned dangerous situation, I never felt like I was in danger at the gas station. The place where I felt most in danger when I think about my childhood was probably Immaculata, where I was the only Black kid in the class. I got in the only fight I've ever been in my entire life was at that school.
Over a racial epithet.
Yeah, when a kid gave me a racial slur. That's danger. That was when my safety was at stake. It wasn't, when I'm on the corner with the people in my community that look out for me and that protect me and that see me and affirm me. I mean, the curriculums and the institutional racism and is more harmful. Mm. you know, than individuals trying to survive and taking care of each other as they try to figure out how to navigate this like world where you can't get enough money to live. Like the thing with my homie, I'm not gonna mention his name because he's probably still in Durham somewhere. I'm not gonna snitch on a brother, but he couldn't support his family on the wage he was getting from BP. He was selling drugs because he needed to do that to supplement his kids, so his kids could not be in the same situation his was in. That was my first lesson on slave wages and capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know, it was on the corner, so. You know.
So how do you bring all this? I mean, again, you think about the complexity of this, but the genius in it all, right? I mean, it's really there. It's actual learning, and it's something that you really need to know about. Right, capitalism drives people to do horrible things. Some of them are in the 1%, and they're doing horrible things to our environment, and it drives people in the lower economic climes to do bad things as well. So there you go, a system from top to bottom that's rotten. But how do you teach this? Now you've got Black Space, for instance. Talk about how all of this life learning has been integrated in a program that just brings kids together for creative projects.
Well, you know, one of the things I try to do at Black Space is it's very simple. I grew up in an environment where I was seen and affirmed and loved through a community, a tribe, a village of people who looked out for me. It was the African American Dance Ensemble. It was Baba Chuck. It was North Carolina Central. It was my mom's bandmates. Everything that we've talked about today. And so with Black Space, I feel like the experience that I had growing up should not be a privilege. It should be a human right for everyone to have access to that kind of loving, nurturing environment. And for kids of color, for Black kids, we don't have access to that. To those kind of resources and that kind of space. And so I was like, yo, we should create a space where artists can come through and kids can learn about beat making. They can learn about coding. They can learn about, digital storytelling, where they can be surrounded by an intergenerational tribe of folks who are kind of aligned around certain principles and values of Pan-Africanism and Black love and social justice. That's what I had, and everybody should have that.
And you talk about too the fact that you were listening to some of that and didn't even realize it because you were listening to Nas and a lot of the hip hop at the time, more or less to be cool, until you figured out what was going on and there was more to it than just you know making money, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think hip hop. What I really learned in listening to hip hop was that the teacher, and I'll quote KRS-One because we call him the teacher. So KRS-One was teaching me more about Black history and about my identity and ancestors than I ever learned ever in a social studies, English, or math class that I got around Durham in the public or private school system, you know. And so that's a problem. Mm-hmm. That's a problem. I shouldn't be learning about my ancestors from Nas only. It should be Nas and, you know, my history teacher. But our curriculums are so centered around Europe and America and kind of paint this picture, this American exceptionalism, you know, patriotic curriculum that only tells one side of the story and doesn't talk about the genocide and the oppression and the structural racism, patriarchy, you name it.
Well, and all of that was stuff that it's interesting because your grandmother's telling you stuff about that, about the kingdoms in Africa.
Right.
And this is during the French toast years. So you roll in your eyes and then you hear Nas and everything. In fact, just to give you a sample of that, why don't we play I Can, or at least a clip from Nas, and then we'll come back to that. We'll kind of make the connection.
We came to this country. We were kings and queens, never porch monkeys. There was empires in Africa called Kush, Timbuktu, where every race came to get books to learn from Black teachers who taught Greeks and Romans, Asian Arabs, and gave them gold. When gold was converted to money, it all changed. Money then became empowerment for Europeans. The Persian military invaded. They heard about the gold, the teachings, and everything sacred. Africa was almost robbed naked. Slavery was money, so they began making slave ships. Egypt was the place that Alexander the Great went. He wasn't shocked that the mountains were Black faces. Shot up their nose to impose what basically still goes on today, you see. If the truth is told, the youth can grow. They'll learn to survive until they gain control. Nobody says you have to be gangsters. Read more, learn more, change the globe.
Ghetto children, do your thing. Hold your head up, little man, you're a king. Young princess, when you get your wedding ring, your man will sing, she's my queen. I know I can.
I can. The rapper Nas, my guest in the studio, hip-hop artist and community organizer Piers Freelon. I Know I Can makes reference to the queen. The queen mother made reference to those kingdoms as well for you earlier in your life.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I would hear Nas and other rappers kind of endorse the narrative that my grandmother had been telling me from childhood, it made it a little more palatable, you know, to go back and accept. But I also think, you know, my grandmother loved me unconditionally. And even though she could sometimes be overbearing or annoying, I knew that it was coming from a place of love. And so when you hear that kind of in other spaces, you recognize that, like, oh, that's the same loving stuff that I got. That's the same vibe and the same rhetoric that I got from this person who loved and nurtured me. So, you know, and Nas is going to be in Durham in a couple months performing at the Art of Cool Festival. He's my favorite rapper, and verses like that are the reason why. And, I mean, it was funny. In school, when I got to college and started studying African-American studies and I learned about the Kush Empire, I was like, yo, that's crazy. Like, I thought Kush was what my mentor was selling off the cash register at the gas station. Kush is a slang term for weed. I didn't know that was actually a place and a people and a legacy and a history. And so, you know, connecting those dots was really powerful for me.
Yeah, and when you think about ways in which terms like that get twisted, too, if you think or just turned around. I mean, forever, when I grew up, when you said, oh, he was all the way out in Timbuktu. So that was so what that meant is the most primitive, far away, exotic, and lost place in the world. It's the capital of an empire in which Europeans came to learn, right? And then it becomes the name for the most exotic, lost place on earth.
Sure.
In the other vocabulary, right?
Yeah, and I mean, and that's part of the. I mean, one of the crazy things about white supremacy is they take something that's beautiful and they'll call it the opposite.
Right.
You know, they'll literally say that this is the opposite of what it actually is. And people, they accept that indoctrination. That's why the Black is Beautiful movement was such a powerful oppositional force, because everywhere else you look, you're being told and it's being reaffirmed, even in little girls looking at dolls, that Black is not beautiful.
And it's interesting to talk about your daughter, because I know you're working on a web project with her. She's 8 years old, and I think this is instructive, because at the age of eight, she came to this observation herself. But tell us the story.
Yeah, this is just such a beautiful thing. So my daughter comes back from her grandmother's house. This is my wife's mom, and she has written a letter. It says, I'm paraphrasing, but it basically says, I like Black people and girls. That's the first sentence. Second sentence. Here's why women should have their own name. Woman has men in it, so we should be called Wowo from now on, because we need like our own name that's not like derivative of men,
right?
You know. And then the last line is, it's nice to be unique. Wow. And it's nice to be unique. Well, so she's saying, like, from now on, adult girls will be called Wowo in our family, and it's nice to be unique. So that whole idea with me and Stella is being turned into a web series. Right. The web series is called It's Nice to Be Unique, and the subject of the web series are going to be Black Wowo, you know.
If you think about it, too, the power of this, because for generations, I mean, if you think about the long civil rights movement and how far back it goes, even before the 60s, when the famous names, Black History Month, the timeline show up, the amount of pushback, right, and the amount of backsliding after each of those generations, it must be encouraging to find somebody who says, wait a minute, I've got this on my own. I get the point at the age of eight. Does it feel like real progress to you at this point, that sort of thing? There's a lot of encouraging signs now, a Me Too movement, the surge in women running for office. How do you feel about it long term?
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel good. I mean, I'm. You mentioned the word Afrofuturism a little while ago, and I identify as an Afrofuturist. And when I think about the future, when I'm looking at my daughter, I think, wow, intersectionality had to be explained to me, you know, by radical Black feminists and professors that I've studied, bell hooks and others. You know, Angela Davis, you know, race, gender, and class. I had to study that. I feel like my daughter, who's read none of those wonderful texts, already understands the basic principles, you know, through that letter. You know, she was saying that we're invisible, you know, yeah. In the interview. We did our first interview a couple weeks ago, and she talks about how invisible black folks are when there aren't black dolls that look like them with natural hair that looks like them. The subject of her first interview was a woman named Yalitza Jean Charles, who is a local entrepreneur. Actually, she came here through an AU accelerator, and her thing is making black dolls, and she was the first interviewee on the show. But Stell talks about being invisible. She talks about WoWo needing to create their own space, and this is all like intersectionality, and it feels like she's kind of stepping right into it at a young age without kind of needing any instruction or to be steered that way. And I think that's definitely a result of everything from Black Lives Matter to Me Too to Time's Up, you know, all these movements coalescing at this time as she's coming to age. I think is definitely a sign that our future will be better than our past.
Pierce Freelon is my guest today, hip-hop artist, community organizer, founder of Black Space, an Afrofuturist youth group. That and more when our conversation continues on The State of Things. Stay with us. Come with us if you're ready tonight. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking to Pierce Freelon today, community organizer, hip-hop artist. And if anybody knows you at all, in this area anyway, you do all this cool stuff that we've been talking about behind the scenes. But The Beast is the band that a lot of people know you for. Talk about how that band came together.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talked about E.K. Poe already. I met Stephen Kaufman, my bandmate, many moons ago playing soccer and kickball. We were later on a soccer team together at the YMCA on Lakewood Avenue. And then, I mean, we went to DSA together. We went to Carolina together.
Drove the arts. Go ahead.
Yeah. By the time we were adults, you know, we'd each been in various bands. I was in a hip-hop group called Language Arts. He had a band, I remember, in high school called Slippery Chicken. that was like one of the first indie rock bands to come out of Durham School of the Arts. And we came together for a jam session, and the vibe was so beautiful. And, you know, I had several years performing and building with Language Arts, where it was just two MCs and a DJ, and I had never rapped over live music before. And it really struck something within me. It ignited something. Again, as an MC that raps over a beat that's provided by a DJ, plus or minus some scratching and some different elements of the beat that will change up from time to time. It's relatively kind of static. It's the same beat we recorded over. With The Beast, it was interesting to have musicians that are improvising live. So if I get more excited or more charged, like, they may switch up the bass line or you know, give some different chords. And so there's this element of kind of collective improvisation, and that was a spark that really resonated.
And out of a real jazz stream as well. So jazz improvisation is really informs.
Definitely. And, you know, growing up for me, jazz was like mom's job. It was not something that I really appreciated very much. But again, kind of like Granny Franny planting these, you know, these seeds of black identity within me. I think my growing up around my mom, I had appreciation of and understanding of what it is to be a jazz musician and to operate in a live context that also, with my studying theater, kind of became a part of our ethos as a band.
I want to play a clip here from one of your latest tracks, Power Man.
Hey,
let's start with Asada. She kinda like the Black Panther, call her T'Challa. And Nina Simone, she like Storm, the way she shocked the globe like a thunderbolt. And Malcolm X's blade, he made the vampires leave us alone. Saul Williams like Falcon when he read us a poem. And Harriet liberated the slaves, she broke the chain. That's why I call her Luke Cage, aka Power, 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 Power Man, Power, Power, Power.
That's a clip from the song Power Man by the Triangle Bass Band, The Beast. My guest in the studio is Beast member, hip-hop artist, and community organizer Piers Freelon. And you've been together for a long time. You've been making music for quite a while now, right?
Yeah, going on 10 years. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and it's been a fruitful kind of evolving collaboration. In addition to performing songs and playing clubs, we also do like educational workshops, kind of based on the curriculums that I learned about, you know, in college and grad school. We have a program called Sankofa where we go into schools, and it's like an hour long presentation about the history of Black music from spirituals to hip hop. And so the Beast has done this, I mean, probably hundreds of times in the Triangle. And it's a big part of what we do as a band.
You were part of an international collaboration, too, called the Beatmaking Lab that took it abroad. Talk more about that.
Yeah, Beatmaking Lab started as a class at UNC. It was a class that was initially taught by Dr. Mark Katz and my business partner, Applejuice Kid. You know, I came in to teach the class in 2012 and was very interested in adding a community component. As is the case with a lot of my stuff, I recognize kind of the privilege and opportunity associated with providing a class like that on a campus like UNC, but also very interested in kind of bridging that gap and opening up that resource to community. So we were, as soon as I started teaching the class, we were looking for a place to do it in Durham somewhere, community centers or studios where we could teach this curriculum free for kids locally. But before we even had an opportunity to do that, we had a colleague who's based in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Dr. Cherie Indalico Rivers, who invited us to do a beat-making lab, like a week-long beat-making hip-hop curriculum in the Democratic Republic of Congo in Goma. So we did a Indiegogo, raised some money to buy tickets and buy equipment to donate. And we went there and did an amazing project, collaborative project, where the kids made a song and we shot a music video for it with Salim Reshamwala. And that led to a web series with PBS where we traveled the world. We went to the Congo was 2012, but in 2013 we were in Panama, then we went to Senegal, Fiji, Ethiopia, all with this PBS web series called Beatmaking Lab.
And it sounds great, of course, and it is. You're making music, you're traveling the world, you're meeting other people, they're developing collaborative projects with you, but you also learn some valuable lessons about traveling abroad, especially from a position of privilege.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was also studying. As we were doing the work, I was also looking at what community organizing and creative artivism looks like from an international perspective. So for example, in the Congo, Petna Ndaliko, who runs the community center there called Yole Africa, they're working with the descendants of Hutu and Tutsi families, and these are ethnic groups that were in a clash that led to a genocide in neighboring Rwanda. So when that genocide was taking place in the 90s, there was this mass exodus of folks kind of fleeing violence that ended up in the Congo, which Goma is right there on the border of Congo and Rwanda. And there's this historic trauma between these different ethnic groups. And so Petna is using hip hop and dance and film and beat making to have this conflict resolution curriculum, really, to kind of bridge the gap between these folks who are at war with one another, whose parents were at war with one another. And so I'm watching that and I'm listening and I'm watching and I'm studying and I'm learning what it is to be in solidarity with them. We didn't, make no mistake, Beatmaking Lab did not come into the Congo with any solutions. We came into a space where a local guy, Petna, had already been working on the solution for a decade.
But talk more about that, because there's a way in which this can also be a kind of cultural imperialism if you're not careful. And so the things that you have to be careful of, and I think you did run afoul of that just once, I think in Fiji, where you know they kind of had your oops moment where you really learned something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, really what's important is that you listen and that you understand that local people have solutions to their own problems. The oops moment you're referring to, yeah, in Fiji, we made a beat that kind of sampled an ancient Fijian chant. And for us, like, we were looking for local music to sample with the, you know, altruistic intentions of making, like, a Moombaton, like, dance rhythm beat with sampling some local music. And so without really understanding the context or the nuances or even the language of what was being said, we heard something that we thought sounded cool. We put it over a beat. We presented it to the community. And the elders were looking at us like, no, this is not appropriate. It turns out that the chant that we sampled was like a funeral dirge. It was a song and chant that they sung when an elder has passed away. And we had mashed that up with like a dance beat, and it was just a really awkward juxtaposition that in our ignorance we didn't know to avoid. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important in cultural work that you center the voices of locals so that they can kind of steer the process. I think unintentionally that was a situation where we kind of steered the process searching for a sample that we thought looked cool without having local folks lead that process, which could have helped us avoid that problem. And of course, you know, once we knew what was up, we changed it. Yeah. And in a way, in presenting it to the elders, that was one kind of layer of accountability, and they told us nah, and we changed it. It would be another thing if we'd released it, whatever. So we had some accountability, but that was one moment where we learned that we need to do even more to center the voices of local folks in this
Most
work.
Of your community building has been in the cultural sphere, and then you ran for mayor of Durham. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, coming up in Durham and seeing how kind of vibrant, especially the Black community that I was nurtured in, was and is. But going back all the way to historic Black Wall Street, you know, before I was born, before my parents, you know, even looked to Durham as a place to build a family, there's a really rich legacy here. And you only need to look at the walls at, like, for example, the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People to see how far the legacy of political activism and organizing and social consciousness and power, political power, economic power, cultural power that Black Durham had. And so for me to come from that and to see the ways in which Durham is transforming in a way that is really erasing and eradicating that Black legacy, it was troubling. It was really, really troubling. And with Mayor Bell's retirement after 16 years, initiating like a paradigm shift, especially in downtown, there's been over $1.5 billion kind of pouring into a 1 mile radius of downtown. And there've been a lot of beautiful changes as a result of that. Like, I'm a musician. There was no Pinhook. There was no Motorco. There were no places to perform as a musician. There was no Deepak. It's been wonderful to be able to engage in some of the new things and some of the ways in downtown has transformed, but it's also pushed a lot of people out. And because I have that historical memory, I know that I don't want history to repeat itself. When policymakers came in with a good idea of building 147 through the middle of the Haiti, and so I'm on the radio. When I said good idea, I use quotation marks with my fingers. Yeah. You know, that was development. That was a policy choice to open up Durham at the expense of Black folks. Mm-hmm. If you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. Mm-hmm. And we're in a moment of intense growth, and I'm seeing some of the same elements that destroyed that historic Black Wall Street community at play now that is ever more kind of shrinking and invisibilizing Black working class folks. And that's just not acceptable. It was almost like, not in my house. Like, this is where I came from. We will not be pushed out. You know, so that led me to look back at the Maya Angelous and the Baba Chucks and the Queen Mother Frances Pierces of my life. What can I do about this? So I saw an opportunity to step up for my generation in the Trump era, in the Republican controlled General Assembly era of our state, we have a progressive bastion in Durham where, wow, it might actually be possible for a young black, thoughtful artist, activist, organizer to do some important political work in the city. So,
what do you think is the impact of your run? You didn't win, but you still feel that you've had a pretty strong impact, just the campaign itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, I'm told time and time again from folks my age that they were really inspired by the fact that I stepped up to run. I hear on a weekly basis, people are continue to talk about how I pushed the conversation in a direction that they don't think it would have gone otherwise, centering poverty as one of the main issues that Durham is facing with. And I think like a big issue that a lot of people like to talk about is kind of affordable housing and especially this election cycle, it was like a really big issue. And we kept talking about, well, you know what? The affordable housing issue in Durham at this point is fueled by poverty. That is the main kind of issue that is driving gentrification and
yeah, they go hand in hand. Evictions. I mean, people like, you can't have all these nice houses and all this great development without somebody losing a house. And often it's being forced out of their houses.
Yeah, being forced out of their houses. And also the public safety crisis, all the millions and millions of dollars that were flowing into, quote, public safety. And we always said on the campaign trail, like, policing and public safety are not the same thing. You want to make the community safe? Give the people jobs, like living wage jobs. And so, you know, we had the audacity to put forward that, you know, work is not a privilege, it's a human right. Everyone should have the opportunity to work. And if the state is not going to provide it and the country is not going to provide it, what can municipalities do to take some of that economic power and to create jobs for people in Durham? And I think those are concepts that are considered radical. It's unfortunate that it's a radical concept that everyone should have access to a living wage job, but that's the reality we live in. So I hope, you know, as an Afrofuturist, I'm trying to embody my inner Harriet Tubman. Mm-hmm. She was saying, let's get free, when people around her were like, hold up, what does that mean? What's going to happen to all the black people? It's like, no, let's get free. And here's a way that we're going to do it. And she built the Underground Railroad before the rest of the country caught on to that needing to be the standard. And so I think that we're pushing the conversation in a direction that it needs to go, and we'll get there because our generation is going to carry that torch. I think that we have the tools that we need to make the changes that we want to see, and we just need we need to start somewhere. So it was a great start.
Well, you start in Durham, and that's going to be my last question, which is that in a progressive city like Durham, all of the candidates who ran here probably wouldn't have a chance in many other places, and wouldn't even be on the ballot in other cities in this state. So what does it mean to have all those ideas in one place? Is this the incubator or is this the last stop? How do you look at it?
That's a good question. I think, you know, well, progressive is another word, speaking of Durham, that I kind of put in quotes or italics. Yeah. Maybe I'd italicize progressive, because there's a certain type of, like, specifically like white liberalism, yeah, that Durham likes to call progressive. But I question in its capacity to achieve progress for all people. Mm-hmm. Because as Durham is progressing, if you look at the progression of Durham, a lot of black folks are progressing out because they're being pushed out in this progressive bastion. So what is it? I mean, I take that term back. Mm-hmm. And I appropriate that, you know, and we need to redefine what progressive is, and it needs to include everyone in Durham, not just progressive with folks, you know, of a certain background or a certain ethnicity. So for me, I want to push Durham to be, you know, the jewel in the South that it was 100 years ago, where things are happening here that aren't happening anywhere else in the world. You know, and I think we have the potential and the capacity and the legacy to be different in a way that is unique to the South and unique to the globe.
Pierce Freelon, community organizer, hip-hop artist, heads the Afrofuturist Triangle-based youth group Black Space. Thank you so much, Pierce. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. It's a real privilege to be here.
You can find links to his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.